So I guess, again, what we hope to be about today is being open and open to the wonders around us. And I would say that our next presenter is superb in this regard for the work that she is doing as a network scientist. This is Katja Vorner. She's assistant professor of information science, director of information visualization lab, director of the cyber infrastructure for Network Science Center, actually several more titles at Indiana University. And with all of those many titles, she's a very personable and a very skilled person who will walk us through the work that she has been doing with MAPS as part of her efforts to really make the worlds of science and scholarly information more intriguing and more accessible to all of us. So welcome.
Thank you, Susan, for organizing this. So Susan approached me first if I would like to present here, and she told, you can do this remotely. I know you have two kids. You don't travel a lot. And then I saw this program, and I'm like, I have to be here. So I contacted Larry Brandt, with whom I have a Digital Government NSF award, and asked him if I can use some of the money in this award to actually attend here. So it's thanks to NSF that I can be here. The title of the talk is Mapping Science, Opportunities and Challenges, and I was very impressed to hear the background and the range of interests which all of you have in this room. And I have to, of course, state that this is not just my work which I'm going to present, but it's the work of many, many, and I will try to acknowledge them as I go along. And there's a huge list of acknowledgments in the end. So just two slides to phrase the challenges and opportunities I really see in front of us. You have a lot of data. Like, I stole this first quote from the science.gov site. 50 million pages. Imagine this. It's an achievement to federate them all. But then now the next achievement will be to make them useful to us all. And I think we have not solved this problem. Our scholarly database, which we maintain at Indiana University, supports cross-searching of publication patent and grant databases. These are databases which are typically stovepipes. They're not wind chimes. I really like this phrase, stovepipes into wind chimes. Those are 18 million records. Again, no human being can just read them in a lifetime. And you don't have to. You don't have a lifetime to read them all because you have to act right now. You have to pull the best resources right now. You don't have this time. And there are some domains of research which only in the English-speaking domain, they produce 40,000 scholarly papers every single month. And there is a real flood of information out there. Interestingly, there is no one human brain anymore. There used to be human brains, like maybe Leonardo da Vinci, who could absorb it all, take it all in, and contribute to all of it. Wouldn't this be nice? But it doesn't exist anymore today. Instead, what we have to find a way that we can all link our brains more effectively and collectively make sense of this. And it's not only access to scientific literature. It's also access to scientific data, to information, and most of all, maybe to expertise. Because expertise, such as reference librarian, or just this phone call to your best colleague, or staying at Debbie's place last night, all these things are incredibly useful to have information flow. It's still people which drive science, and it's still people which connect us to the most useful resources, in many cases at least. Right now, we are using search engines, and I can compare this with poking a needle charged with a search query, and we poke it in this haystack of unknown size and consistency and shape, and we pull it out, and we have this rank-ordered list of items on there. And again, we do not know why they're rank-ordered this way. However, it is very important to know this in order to judge what you actually got on this needle hanging down. And then you go one by one through there, and oftentimes you find facts very quickly this way. So for fact-finding, search engines are marvelous. And I deeply acknowledge what Google does for this planet. And I also like their ambition to really make mankind's knowledge universally accessible to everybody. And I think that's very similar to what governmental agencies are interested in doing. However, besides local kind of retrieval of linked pages and similar pages, there is no way to use or abuse search engines to get a global view of the web or of trends and patterns and outliers. And they are just not the right tool if you need to forecast the future. They are not the right tool if you need to discover emerging trends. If you want to see how science evolved over the last 100 years, they're not the right tool for this, and don't really seem to have a good tool for this. And you don't need such a tool every day, but from time to time, it would be nice to fly up, to have an up button, and Google could maybe at some point develop an up button. I mean, they also have Google Maps, and the two Scholar, Google Scholar and Google Maps are actually a great base for creating an up button for Google. However, maybe the best analogy we have for what we need is maps, and maps of our planet, and also conceptual maps. They have guided mankind's explorations for many, many centuries. And if you remember some of the early maps of our planet, they were not perfectly correct. They look very, very different from what we know today our world looks like. And yet they avoided, they helped avoid monsters, and they helped people find prosperous lands, and they brought people back to their homes. And wouldn't it be nice, and would it be possible also, to just map mankind's knowledge and to map it in a way that you can use them as seed charts, so that you can find all those areas of fruitful collaboration, that you can see where things emerge, that you can see patterns and trends, and to guide our scientific exploration, but also to guide collaboration finding, and to even build a bridge, and maybe that's the most important part about maps, which we are all trained to understand throughout our school life and even before school starts, to help to use maps to connect what we are doing in ivory towers as scientists to what people need to understand in daily life. And I think another bridge which maps can do, and I will get to back to this later, is to also help translate between different languages and cultures. And I will get to this. I think these two bridges are very important. Ivory Tower to general public, and I think I should quote them this way. It's not really upper and lower. It's really on the same base, because it's, and it, maybe it's even this way, because I actually get some money from tax money, so it flows down to me. But also really across the different cultures and languages, because it's not only English-speaking material which has all the good nuggets of knowledge. It's just that this is what we can understand and read, most of us in this room here. So I have a rather lengthy talk prepared, and I'm not sure we have time for all of this. And maybe I should do a poll of what you would be most interested in. So let me give you a quick overview of what I can do. First of all, there is in front of you, at least in front of those which they are brave enough to sit around this wonderfully big table, there are poster versions of the Mapping Science exhibit, and you have seen the real exhibit in the video, and I can talk a little bit more about this. This is a 10-year, 10-iteration exhibit. We are now in year 3. The first iteration is all about the power of maps. Why are they so powerful? Second iteration is all about the power of reference systems. How many dimensions might a reference system for the depiction of science have? And the third iteration is about the power of forecasts. What can we learn from the forecasting of epidemics, of seismic hazards, of economic models, or the forecasting of scientific activity? So I could walk you through some of those maps. There are always four existing maps from any kind of area of research, compared and contrasted with six maps of science, potential maps of science. And this is true for each of the three iterations. So I could walk you through them. This is for those which love maps and which just love to see good examples of visual depiction of mankind's endeavors. The second item here is, how are these maps generated? This goes more into what algorithms are used, what is the process, the multi-step process from data collection over a lot of data cleaning, data integration, thresholding, analysis, potentially modeling if you want to forecast layout into activity design. And then also some smaller case studies and what you can take away from those. And then the third item is about scholarly marketplaces. How can you create an infrastructure which is maybe analogous to the Hubble telescope, which allows us to see things which are far away, or to infrastructures which physicists have generated for themselves, like the particle accelerator, which allows them to see things that you can't see with your naked eye. How can we create an infrastructure, a kind of macroscope, if you wish, which helps us to see trends and patterns and outliers and details and overviews in scientific data, information, knowledge, expertise? How can you build such a thing? And it's not only getting your hands on high-quality data. It's actually what comes after, all the many algorithms, and how would you create a true cyber infrastructure to analyze all this and to potentially at some point serve it as a daily science weather forecast on TV. So I have these three, and I don't think I can squish them all in 1 hour.
Two now. We could do the third one.
Okay.
After lunch, after the other.
Okay.
We kind of shorted you. Equipment delays.
Yeah.
So
let's start with the visual feast then. So you might have seen this Places and Spaces website. The exhibit has a physical exhibit, which needs a forklift now to get anywhere. And that's a really different beast from what I was used to do in my life. So I'm used to writing papers, and you write these papers, they get uploaded, and they're out of your way. This thing is big. It's a monster. You need to get in good contact with all kinds of storage, all kinds of shipping companies. It's just very different. Typically, maybe don't take on such a beast. It's really a hassle also. But it's interesting because these are large-scale maps. So the versions that you see here on the table are actually smaller versions. They are now so large, of very, very large-scale maps. And in many cases, the map makers take pride in putting as much data as they can while making it still readable. And so in many cases, in these small versions, you won't be able to see it all. Debbie McPherson, who happens to be here today, she and I were the curators for the first two iterations of this exhibit, and then Debbie took on a very nice, interesting new job. And so Julie Smith joined me, and we both happen to be at Indiana University right now. However, the advisory board for this exhibit comes from all kinds of different areas of research, but also is very international. And we really use this advisory board a lot. The video which you have just seen showed you some footage of the display of the exhibit in the New York Public Library last year. We also had it in Chicago at a convention of the chemical societies there. And as you see, there are... Do we have a laser pointer here somewhere? Oh, yeah. I see it up there, but if I go it down, you don't see it. No, I can go over.
Oh, would you like?
Here.
Look on
it. Turn it on.
Here. One, two, yeah. So, created diagrams. So you have a map of science, and you have a map of the world, and this 3D shape of science, there's actually pedestrial where you have a touch panel integrated. The projectors which then project low resolution images onto those two high resolution maps. Actually the same maps which you have here on the table. The neat thing about this illuminated diagram setup is that you have the high density of the print resolution, 300 dpi in a clear format, and overlays the interactivity of what you. And still, the low resolution is too bad because all you do is illuminate. There's a so-called attractor mode, which just has like a radar swipe, go over the map of science. And whenever it hits one of those science nodes, let's say chemistry, then in the map of the world, you will see highlight all those places on our planet, which do chemistry research. The data which is used in here is ISI data, Thomson Scientific, and they were nice enough to give us permission to use the data in this setup. 800,000 scientific publications were laid out in a two-dimensional space here using VxWatch, which is a layout algorithm developed by Sandia National Labs, And they sort each other out in space according to how often they are together. They will be closer in space. I will try while explaining this interesting force-directed placement layout algorithm. So you have 800,000 nodes, and you have all their interrelationships. So a huge matrix, 800,000 times 800,000, and you know in each cell how often they have been sited together. And then based on those values, this algorithm pulls those nodes together which have been sited very often and pushes those apart which have not been sited together. And interestingly enough, science lays out as a ring, a kind of donut shape. And that is interesting because, first of all, it's nice because we were very concerned that something would be in the middle. And whatever it was, other people would try to pay us to make them be in the middle. And we were very concerned about this because this always happens. The people which paid for maps, world maps, they were always in the middle. They always had the most gorgeous woman around them. They always had the greenery around them, and their land just looked the most promising, the most prosperous of all. So fortunately, we were lucky in this case, and it lays out in a ring. Interestingly also...
Do you mind if people...
Please feel free to get close.
We're not that formal here.
And actually, I can go to a slide so that maybe not... no, I can't. Sorry. So let's... And you see this radar swipe going over here and illuminating some of those lines. The interesting part is that Kevin Boyack and De Clavans, who did this layout, they oriented the map and they rotated and mirrored it in a way that mathematics, as the most theoretical and maybe purest science, is on the top. And then as you go down clockwise, you get physics and then chemistry with the inorganic part here. And then from chemistry into earth sciences, into biomedical research, huge part of biomedical research, also due to the funding, to the large amount of funding which goes into it, over into psychology, statistics with a little appendix to law and business, and then via statistics back to mathematics. And computer science, which I got my PhD in, is right underneath mathematics. And if you fold in ISI proceedings data, this area becomes much more denser and more dominant, as it should be. Now, as this radar swipe goes over here, as I mentioned before, it then illuminates in the map of the world different areas of science. Via the touch panel display, you can actually touch any area on the map of the world or on the map of science, and you will see highlight in the other map the respective areas. So if you, for instance, now in the map of the world, touch Harvard University, let's say, if you have your pointy fingernail, and typically you can't do it, so it's just too aggregated, but let's assume you could, then you could actually see the illumination pattern of what Harvard University's strengths are illuminated in the map of science. And you could do this also for Stanford, and you could try to compare the two, et cetera. Newer versions will actually allow you this zoom in. So we just re-implemented this software so that you can have successive details of the map of science, but also of the map of the world. So you could imagine to zoom into U.S., so you would have another map of U.S. And you could even zoom into Boston, and then you would have all the major research institutes there. And then you would have an easier time to click on them and see what happens in the other maps. So it's a very neat way to actually see how science is distributed locally and globally in terms of scientific topics, but also in terms of geospatial location. You also see that there are these larger maps. So this is the first iteration of the exhibit. There are these globes by Inko Günther, so-called world processor globes. They are illuminated from inside, typically. And then we have also these activities for children. So our idea was, first of all, we would love to see not only maps of the world hang in every classroom in this country, but also worldwide. But we would also like to have a map of science hang right next to it, because I think it would be very useful for children to understand how the many different topics they are studying all day long, math and physics and biology, how they relate to each other and how they draw from each other and why it is important to learn a lot about math and statistics if you want to succeed in psychology, etc. But here we have these science puzzle, hands-on science puzzle maps for children. Now you have a map of science and a map of the world, which is actually using the same base maps which were used here, but they were now rendered with watercolor paintings by Philip Palmer. And you have inventions and inventors, which you have to place in the right positions on both maps. And it's quite challenging to do so. Ambition we had was to have an equal coverage of all the inventions and inventors on the map of the world. And it's not trivial, because if you open a science book in America, you get all the American inventions and inventors. You open it in Europe, you get all the European ones, or mostly European ones. And I don't speak all the Asian languages, but I assume it's the same fact there. So we tried our best to get a good coverage, also with help from colleagues from the science museums we are working with. And then the same set of 18 inventions inventors, they're also supposed to distribute evenly on the map of science. So there was an interesting battle there. And then it's very interesting to actually put them in the right place, and then you turn it around and you have the other set. So if you started with inventions, you have the inventors on the other side, and of course it's totally scrambled up. So you have to start all over again. So these are our first attempts to really get it into the hands of children. And I should also say that all these maps are for sale, and whatever we sell, we take the money and try to get it to children. So that's a good way of supporting this effort. This is a different setup of the illuminated diagram displays. These are two Best Buy TV screens, and just on those podests. And this is the pedestal where you can then interact with this setup. So we are also experimenting with different technology, hardware, software technology here. Next, this exhibit goes to the American Museum of Science and Energy at Oak Ridge, Tennessee, and I'm looking forward to have more interaction with the OSDI people there. They also managed to get Eugene Garfield to give one of the invited talks there, so that should be very interesting. Before I go on, I should talk a little bit about those maps here on the table. So in front of those three gentlemen, you have the first iteration of the exhibit. And again, it's always four existing maps compared and contrasted to six maps of science. And so this was the iteration in 2005. We thought the best way to introduce this ability that you can map science to the general public is to start with something they know, which is maps of the world. So we used maps of the old maps of the world and compared and contrasted them with new maps of science. And obviously, geographic map making is thousands of years old. Map making of science is about 10, 15 years old, just because the technology wasn't in place and the digital data wasn't available to actually do this before this time. There were some pioneers which envisioned it, but the first map was really only created about 10 years back. You also see how wonderfully wrong some of those old maps were. You see how wonderfully honest those map makers were. For instance, in the new map of the whole world, which is right there, you see that Australia, the boundaries were just not known yet, so they left them blank. There are also islands, which just are no-named islands, and they just put down no-name island. And I wish today's information visualization researchers would be so honest, and they would just leave it blank if they don't have the data, or if the data has an uncertainty of 80%, blank, because maps are very susceptible to maps. People believe, they trust maps, and you have to be very careful. We also included one of Minard's maps here, in this case, Tufte's rendering of Napoleon's retreat, because we really would like to have at some point, sooner rather than later, maps of dynamic developments in science. The maps which you see in the first iteration of the exhibit, they all use very different metaphors. So they are node link diagrams like the one by Henry Small of All of Science, or geographic metaphors used by, like the one by Andre Skupin in the top middle, or so-called cross maps by Stephen Morris, or tree maps by Mark Smith at Microsoft, or the subway metaphor by Keith Nesbitt, or for the structure of all of science by Dick Clavins and Kevin Boyack, which uses a kind of galaxy metaphor. And we do not claim that any of those six metaphors is going to be best to depict scholarly knowledge, but he would like people to think about what metaphor might work best to communicate our knowledge. And each of those maps actually has a very nice story, and I'm just wondering if I should tell you one or two of those. Let me tell you the one about the geographic map, which depicts the last 10 years of geography research. Here, Andrei Skupin took the last 10 years of abstracts submitted to the annual conference of geographers in America. And he fed it into self-organizing maps and rendered it using a geographic information system. And then he has this landscape of different hills and valleys. And each hill represents an area of research that is highly homogeneous and consistent to each other. And so you can read off the labels of those mountains, which is GIS and population and water and development and space, etc. And then there's this valley in the middle of all those mountains. And it is still not clear if this is the valley of the lost and confused, because it is really inhomogeneous in itself. So all the abstracts in there are very different from each other. Or if this valley actually is an area where the sediments from all the surrounding mountains are running down and create a very fruitful research environment. Right underneath is this subway map. And this is actually done by a PhD student who had a very, very hard time to communicate to his advisor what his PhD thesis was about. And so he tried and tried for a while, and then at some point just didn't communicate well, and he gave up and went to London to forget about this thing and just have a fun weekend. And in London he saw the tube map. And he thought, well, I can render all the many lines of thought which go through my PhD thesis as a subway map. And his advisor, Peter Eads, who is actually the inventor of the full spring embedding layered algorithm, he loved tube maps, so that was a match made in heaven. And Keith is now Dr. Keith Nesbitt, so this all worked out. So each of those maps has a very interesting story, and we are right now working on a so-called Atlas of Science, which will have all these 30 maps in it, together with a lot of explanation of how they are made, why they were made, how to interpret them, and a larger section also on the future of science maps. And the book is going to come out, published by ESRI, which is a map-making company, so that's appropriate, because you wanted to have large-scale, full-color versions of those maps. The second iteration is all about reference systems. So you see the frequency allocation of the United States, so kind of a linear, one-dimensional reference system. You see the periodic table of elements, a tabular reference system. And there were many other attempts to map the periodic elements. You have geographic and astronomic reference systems. And imagine trying to create an astronomic reference system. Everything is rotating around everything else, so it's non-trivial. And still today, any astronomer, they can point in any segment in the sky and retrieve everything which was ever measured, collected, modeled, simulated, photographed, anything. So just based on this spatial pointing and location. Wouldn't it be nice to have something like this for science? So you would know, okay, F6 is mathematics, D9 is physics. And whenever you need something, you go there. So compared and contrasted are now potential reference systems for science. And again, we don't claim that any of those will be the best one, but we would like people to think about these things. So there is Eugene Garfield's original historiograph. So one reason why he created the ISI citation database was that he needed better raw material to automatically map science. And he then developed tools to do this automatic citation mapping. And his site software is now available commercially and for non-commercial purposes. And so this is just one dimension, time running by and papers citing each other. Down here you have a history flow visualization of one Wikipedia page, a page starting off being created by three authors and then over time increasing in length, growing up. And you see how many people actually are participating in the design and editing and re-editing of a Wikipedia page. So all the many colors you see represent all the many users which have been managing and taking care of this page. And you see deletions and you see major additions, etc. And the final page is actually also shown there, and you see the correspondence in the color coding, even though the page probably goes down here. The top middle map is one which we created in the lab together with Bradford Paley. This one was designed because we wanted to provide a means to see the goodness of fit between any kind of hierarchical data organization and the data it tries to represent or to organize. So many, many taxonomies, classification hierarchies, directory structures, ontologies exist out there. And in many cases, they organize rather large amounts of data. Here you see the U.S. patent classification hierarchy, which has 160,000 classes, trying to organize 3 million patents, U.S. patents only. In the beginning, we thought, well, we just map the entire hierarchy, and then next to each class, we put little dashes, kind of like bar graphs, each representing one patent, and then you at least see how filled those classes are. And the height of each bar can represent how well a patent fits in this class. And so you see all these black sheep immediately, and the librarians can just click on them and see if they may have to reclassify them, etc. Now, when we computed how much space we would need to just plot 160,000 classes, it turned out if you use 6 PT type fonts, so the smallest you can select in Word, and you do overplotting, so you always plot half on top of each other, then you need about 10 meters of space, and this is times 3 if you want it in foot, just to plot the entire thing. And it's heavily overplotted, and it goes down to 15 levels of depth. And there are librarians out there which try to optimize this so that it always best fits the 3 million patents and every future batch of patents coming in. It's a very daunting task, and I don't even know if it can be done. So I think there are ways that you can at least visualize what you got right now and then use these visualizations to help you understand the enormous amount of data you're actually dealing with, but also the structure of the data you're dealing with. There are circular reference systems, which also come with a nice story. So if you have questions later on, ask me about this one also. There's a map of scientific paradigms where the more vital research communities are given in red. And vitality here is defined by the average reference age. So those communities which have papers which cite very recent papers, so very fast progressing research domains, they are indicated with darker dots. And again, it very much depends on what kind of publishing mechanism you are using. So if you have e-prints, you're automatically much, much faster. If you use books, then it's going to be slower before you publish the next book, and the next book which can cite this book, it will take longer. So it's also a matter of the publishing mechanisms. And then, of course, the geographic representation of science. And here, actually overlaid is the increase in patents over time. And Ingo Günther, as a true artist, he warped the globe, which he had perfectly done with the perfect size and indication of the number of patents. He warped it back into this wonderful building. Or shape, so that the original Excel graph is now perfectly visible again. So that's a more artistic rendering. And we work extensively with artists, because if I render some of those data sets as an engineer and slash computer scientist, it would look very different. And thanks to NSF again and the Creative IT program there, we now also have an artist in residence program at the center I'm directing, and I'm very, very proud of this one. This is the third iteration of the exhibit, so this is all about forecasting science. Can it be done, and how far, and how conservative should we be, or should we not be? So here again, existing forecasts of seismic hazards, which actually have an impact on building standards. So these are standard predictions which are done and then have an impact on what kind of buildings are built where. you have predictions of when our oil resources are going to cease to exist or are going to go down enormously. You have modeling of epidemic diseases worldwide or locally. And you have also economic models which help you understand the impact of certain decision, economic decision-making, and are even available online, and multiple people can log in and take their bit, and then the result of the or the modeling result depends really on the input of all the many participants which voted online for certain decisions. So these models, which were designed in very different domains of research, how can we learn from those efforts for the simulation of scientific activity and the forecasting of science activity? Here, again, we have six potential forecasts. One is a 50-year forecast done by the Institute of Scientific Institute for the Future, sorry for the lapses. And that's an ambitious project to do, to forecast the next 50 years. And they do have some wild cards in there, but it's very interesting to also read about this forecast. Then we did a depiction of the last 110 years of the physical review data set. So the Physical Society was very clever, and they scanned and made available all the back years of physical review. And you can map this, and you can overlay predictions of Nobel laureates, for instance, the ones done by ISI, Thomson Scientific. And you can also overlay citation patterns, because in many cases these predictions are made based on young papers, highly cited papers, etc. You have work by Xiaomei Shen in on astronomy data, showing that independent of the tools which were available to astronomers, the strength of the telescopes which were available, predictions were really made outwards from planet Earth being in the center outwards to more and more distant stars and galaxies. It also shows the co-author network and recent discoveries. We have a visualization of science, math, and technology-related articles in Wikipedia. And it actually uses the same base map which was used in this large-scale Wikipedia visualization, which shows all of the English Wikipedia and activity and editing activity bursts. So the size and color coding of the notes on this particular large-scale version was done based on editing activity, so you get to see what people are interested in most. And they're not sure if we should censor it or not. We decided not to and made a note that it's for mature audiences. So if you have a chance, look at it a little. It's very interesting to see what pockets of topics Wikipedia covers. And it does also cover math, science, and technology quite a bit. Then there is a map, and so here the forecasting is done by just looking at bursts of activity, sudden increases in usage or editing frequencies, which are typically a very good predictor of future growth in certain areas. The top right map of all of science is a map which was generated thanks to UCSD and Art Ellis sponsorship there, based on ISI and Scopus data. So for the very first time, somebody had sufficient resources to buy both data sets and to map them in one unified map. And this is also the first map which has the arts and humanities on it. And it was always not clear in how far arts and humanities would create their own continent, or if they would be belonging to mainland, and it happens that they are connected, so that's good. And underneath this large-scale map, you see how you see predictions of how the different areas of science are going to become closer to each other, or are pushing each other away. The lower right rendering is a hypothetical drawing by Daniel Seller of how science grows from the very first initial scientific thought outwards, kind of building tree rings of good years with lots of funding and lots of papers generated, and bad years where everybody's in war and no papers are generated. You see yellow used as an indicator for injections of money, and then lots of people clustering around there trying immediately. You see one of the very first monsters, or actually the first monster in a map of science, Daniel Seller rendered one of the voids of the undiscovered unknown lands as a monster here. And you see these tentacles coming out from the surface of science, reaching for new opportunities, for novelty, for money, for driving factors. And of course, there are no people mapped in here, because we all are mortal, so we are not going to be in this picture, even though you could put our trails over there, you could put our current activity over there. Ultimately, we will be gone, but what we leave behind is those termite piles, or these kind of structures of papers, which make us immortal, hopefully. There. So that's maybe why we are writing papers all day long. I can talk more about it, but I think I should go on here. This, by the way, is a map of the Internet Movie Database. If some of you like movies, go look at this one. All right, let's go over. and please ask me more about those. They're really neat stories. Let me moot this one and go over to science mapmaking, general process and recent insights. So there are lots of different papers and special issues, and there's an entire special issue of PNAS on how these knowledge domain maps can be generated. I would like to point out that there are also two recent review articles in ARIS, the Annual Review of Information Science and Technology. One is in 2003 by Kevin Boyack, Xiaomei Shen, and myself on visualizing knowledge domains. So these are 70-page long detailed reviews of how this is done. There's also a recent article on network science, which is now out. I should update this reference, on network science. In many cases, what we are mapping here, these are networks. These are networks of people co-authoring with each other. These are networks of papers citing each other. These are networks of institutions and countries and governments collaborating with each other. And so network science and everything what physicists have done in condensed matter physics, or social scientists have done in social network analysis, or internet researchers or web researchers have done in their domains of area of research, becomes very, very relevant for the analysis and mapping and study of science. And that's also why I direct a cyber infrastructure for network science center, because network science is really at the core of studying science, even though you can also do it based on keywords. And yes, we are using these kind of algorithms. But if you want to map science on a global scale, you have to take into account linkages. All global maps of science are generated based on linkages. If you do it based on keywords, it's not going to work. Words are used too differently. And even if you use latent semantic analysis or topics or any other semantic technology, and there are many out there, it's not going to work across the sciences. If you have one very small area of research, do it. It's just magic, but across the different sciences, there's nothing I know of, and I would love to be convinced otherwise, that works. In general, the process of analyzing and mapping science would come from data extraction. So you do searches via major databases, or you use science.gov. That would be actually fascinating to try create an interface to such a service. And you do this either term-based, so you enter a few keywords, and hope for the best, or you do it by cited reference search. So you have a set of seminal papers, and you get all the papers that cite those and all the papers they cite, and you do this two rounds, and you get a quite sizable data set this way. Then, of course, you check that you got the right stuff. So you look at the sources, for instance, the journal names, and you sort out all those which are clearly out of what you wanted. Or you make sure that you have all the major journals in your domain of interest. Next, you would identify what unit of analysis you want to consider. Do you want to have a map of all journals, or of all papers, or of the people which write the papers, or of terms, just to identify what this area is about? It might be very useful to have a topic term map. Let's assume you have selected papers. Then you have to identify what makes two papers similar. Is it that they cite each other? Is it that they are cited by a third paper? Is it that they share references? Is it that they share lots of terms in common? These will all generate very different maps, which are all very interesting to look at, and you will take different expertise away from them. Oftentimes, you also apply thresholds. Maybe you don't care about those papers which have been never cited before. And so you reduce your data set by half, which is nice computationally because it's already using a lot of computational power to just deal with half of the data that you just harvested. Next, you want to reduce your very high-dimensional data set. I mentioned 800,000 papers by 800,000 papers, and you have most cells are actually zeros. They have never been co-cited together, or they don't share any terms together. Still, you have this very large matrix. And what you want to boil this down to is two dimensions. So 800,000 by 800,000, so two. Huge loss of information. Still, the idea is that nobody can understand, at least we can't understand, 800,000 dimensions by 800,000 dimensions. And some spaces are even larger. Like, for instance, the Scopus ISI map, much larger data set. If you use CiteSphere, 400,000 unique terms. So if you do a term document matrix, you have a huge matrix there. So you want to use so-called dimensionality reduction techniques to map this into a 2D space, and there are some listed here. In many cases, you also want to then cluster and group things which belong to each other, which are highly interconnected or which share a lot of words in common or are from the same country, whatever it is you are mapping. So you want to identify clusters, and you want to draw in cluster boundaries. And some of the dimensionality reduction techniques, they don't really give you layers. They just give you a lower dimensional space. And so now here you need a force-directed placement, which you have seen in the illuminated diagram display. Or you need so-called triangulation techniques or other techniques to lay it out in 2D or potentially also in higher dimensional spaces, but ultimately fold it back into 2D because this is really what we can read. Lots of people love to fly through information spaces, and I came to U.S. because I wanted to combine artificial intelligence, which I had done in my PhD work, with virtual reality front ends. I thought this is the coolest thing you can possibly do. And it still is, but the trouble is not so many CAPE systems exist. So whatever you design would only be for those few which have access to those advanced virtual reality output devices. And so I went on, and now I'm back to paper, which is quite interesting to me. So yes, flying through information spaces is fun, but if you run usability studies in there, very few people, or most of the people, they have lots of fun, and they rate these interfaces highly, but they don't take information away from it necessarily. And I'm very interested in helping people understand their data and make use and help them do better decision-making. So now you have it laid out. You have it in either on the screen or on paper, and now you want to interact with it. So you want to actually search for your name. Where am I? And then you get this, you are here. Okay, good. These are my papers. I trust this thing now. And there's a huge difference between searching and mapping. If you enter your name into Google Scholar, you will never expect that all of your scientific publications come up. Never, ever. Try yourself. Just Google, and you will be happy if the major ones show up. If you look at a map of science and you do not find every single one paper of yours, you won't trust this map anymore. We have huge quality requirements on those maps. And this is also a reason why we try, as best as we can with the resources we have, to create a log file for every single map we create. So you know what data went in, how was the data treated, what was omitted, if we, for instance, threw out those which were not cited, what was done to this data so that everybody could potentially repeat this and also understand why this one paper doesn't show. Maybe it just didn't have a year in the original database, and then it was discarded because of this. But we have a listing of all the papers which were discarded because of data trouble points. So I think you have to have this quality. Otherwise, people are not going to trust those maps. Okay, now you know you are here. But then you want to see all your collaborators. So maybe you want to click on yourself and see all your co-authors. And you would like to zoom and pan over and see another friend or colleague of yours and his collaborators. So you want to make comparisons. And you really want to interact with this data. It's not just that you want to just this map and that's it. I think now the fun part starts. In many cases, you find out that it was not the perfect data set to use. So you go all the way to the beginning of this pipeline and feed in more data, retrieve more data, and then you go through this pipeline again. Now, we have been doing this science mapping since about 7 years now, and we had always a need to set up an infrastructure to support this pipeline, because in the beginning, actually all these different algorithms, they come in all kinds of different programming languages with all kinds of different input-output formats. And it was a huge hassle to do this pipeline twice or three or four or five times, which you typically have to do because only when you map it, you see that the data is wrong or has problems, not immediately wrong. So that's maybe one reason why we started to do cyber infrastructure development quite early. What I wanted to show you here is just the evolution of the co-authorship network. And this is a network of which captures only one out of three information visualization conferences, and no books, no journal papers, and it starts in 88, I believe, and runs up to 2004. Each node here represents one researcher, which is part of this data set. It's labeled by the last name of this researcher, and the size of the node represents the number of papers this researcher published, actually area sizes used here, not diameter, that's important to note. The thickness of the lines between the nodes represents how often they co-author together. There is color coding going on for edges and nodes. The edge color represents when they started to collaborate, so how old is this the bond between them. And the node color represents how many citations they received. And you can also then go ahead and look at those clusters which are formed, and they are very locally grouped. People which are close to each other, they co-author much, much more than they would across distances. Now, if you look at this, then you see a number of interesting things. One is that there's a huge difference if you work at a research lab like Xerox PARC. So Ed Robertson, Stuart Card, and Jack McKinley, for the most part of what this data set covers, worked all at Xerox PARC. Ed Robertson later on went to Microsoft, and there are some movements going on. And they have very strong bonds. They don't teach, so they do mostly research, and they have been collaborating a lot. Very different to Ben Schneiderman. Typically at one university, you have only one person doing information visualization, if at all. And he now works with this incoming, outgoing stream of lots of students, many of which actually disappeared into industry doing very interesting product development, so they might not publish more after they leave, or they become their own research professors. You also see that there are some nodes which are rather large and still not very dark, and this is kind of an indication that they published a lot, but nobody really cited them, and that's maybe not what you want. On the other hand, it could also be that they just recently published a lot, and therefore nobody had a chance to cite them yet. And so there are a number of things which you can take away from such a network. And we are in the process of setting up infrastructures where you can just feed in your data in ISI format or in a BibTeX or EndNote format, and then it just gives you an animated GIF or gives you the files to actually do this on the fly. We have been engaging in a number of studies where I was very interested to see if there is something like a global brain emerging on this planet. So this is one paper we have on this. And we wanted to know if science today is driven by prolific single experts or by high-impact co-authorship teams. And so we developed a new approach to allocate citational credit. Typically, citations are attributed to the main author or divided by number of co-authors, and each gets a fraction, or the full count is given to every author. Here we actually attributed it to the linkages between the authors. And then you actually can see how successful certain co-authorship relationships are, which ones did collect all the citation counts. And we use the very same data set you just saw animated over time. And we also then came back with a novel weighted graph representation, and we animated the growth. And we developed a number of measures. So this was in collaboration with two physicists. And the nice result of this study is that it really seems to be the case, at least for this data set, that those which are effective collaborators in research projects, they are going to attract the most citations if you're interested in citations. Obviously, there are lots more which you would like to get out of science, including health benefits and societal benefits. But if you're just interested in citations, then definitely it makes sense not to be the lone wolf researcher, but it makes a lot of sense to collaborate with other experts. In another study, we used an 18-year PNAS data set to see if space still matters in the Internet age. Do you still have to work at a major research institution in order to do major work and to produce high-quality, highly cited research? And so PNAS, as you know, is mostly biomedical research, and here we only use the U.S. data, not worldwide data. Obviously, other countries also submit and get published in PNAS. But here, just for U.S., we could actually answer the first two questions with yes, and the third question, if the Internet leads to more global citation patterns, is no. So even though it might be the case that people read more across scientific and spatial and national boundaries, if it comes to filling those slots at the end of the paper, the citation references, I think they still consider whom they have to face again at the next conference or in the hallway or at the coffee maker or wherever they face their colleagues. And then they typically decide to cite rather locally, which is an interesting fact. And even maybe even more so when it gets so overwhelming with this flood of information. The Wikipedia visualization, which you see back there, we wanted to know what topics Wikipedia covers, what articles are cited the most, and if Wikipedia covers math, science, and technology. And it was very interesting for us to actually see it. And the one link, which I believe doesn't work right now, and I'm trying to get it fixed for my technically more worse people. It's a Wiki map representation of this large map there, so a Google map representation of the Wikipedia map. And the reason for adding this link to the site, and I hope it will work again, so maybe go back and use it and also show it to others, is that I believe Google Maps are a great way to serve large-scale maps of science. And you can even use Wikimapia technology that then allows you to annotate those maps. So you cannot only serve data, you can also invite people to help clean data. And in many cases, as I mentioned in the very beginning when we introduced each other, it is a real problem that the data which is collected today about our scientific results is collected the way it is. So it's kind of buried into papers, and it's very hard to get it out of papers. And in many cases, we don't have unique author identifiers. We don't have unique journal identifiers. We don't have unique geolocations. We don't have unique science reference identifiers, which in our case are actually journals. And I'm happy to talk more about science referencing, which is very similar to georeferencing. So you can just science locate my pathway through science, for instance, anybody's pathway to through science. You can science locate and also geospatially locate the core competencies of certain companies or institutions, etc. And that's really a very nice view of activity patterns. So this is the one map which you saw over there. And I think I should conclude, right, because we wanted to leave some time for discussion also. So these scholarly marketplaces are all about setting up an environment, a cyber infrastructure, which is very similar to Flickr and YouTube. So Flickr and YouTube are sites which allow anybody to share images and video. What we would love to do is to set up an environment which is a very lightweight core where anybody can upload data, or scientific algorithms. Obviously, it's a little different if you now allow people to upload data in any kind of format or allow them to upload software written in Fortran or C or Java or anything, yet you promise that they will be able to easily compile tools which have custom fillings of data sets and algorithms relevant to their own area of research. So maybe the best I can explain this in brief is, imagine this large table here. And imagine all the network scientists out there. So you have biologists over here, though they occupy a third of this table maybe. Then you have social scientists, you have physicists, you have scientometricians like myself, you have internet researchers, web researchers, etc., economists and communication researchers. Lots of people study networks today. And let's assume we just concentrate on network science for now, but this table could, of course, be larger, and then you have other sciences and other needs as well. But right now, this is the table for network science. Now, in some cases, it makes a lot of sense for me to harvest the best clustering algorithms out there, and I do not care if they come from biology or physics or social science. I want all of them, and I want all of them in my custom tool, and I want them to eat my data. And I don't really care what kind of converter sequence is in between my data set and the input format which this biologist's clustering algorithm understands. However, at the end of the day, I would like to have my data clustered in different ways, and I want to see the result. So we would another scenario would be I'm interested to set up a pipeline which eats my data, cleans it two different ways, and actually I just developed a new way of cleaning it, and I want to compare two existing cleaning mechanisms, and I again want to see the result or examine the result. So I want to also check my newer result against old algorithms. Right now, this is very cumbersome because in many cases, these algorithms, they are only available in different tools which might be protected, so I have to purchase them. I don't have the money. I also don't have so much time to actually get them all. Wouldn't it be nice if I could just go to a site like Flickr or YouTube, type in clustering or data cleaning or whatever, and I get all those? Similarly, I might go, just like in YouTube, you go to the site and you tell, hey, I'm a biologist, and I'm not an expert yet, I'm a student. What do biologists typically download? And then you get kind of the download statistics, based on the download statistics from biologists which have identified themselves, you get all those which they typically download, and you get your kind of custom filling for biologists. Similarly, you might be somebody who is very interested in semantic analysis. Could be attributes associated with network nodes. And you might really be in love with one particular algorithm. Wouldn't it be nice to have some kind of Amazon feature that if you like this algorithm, you also like this other algorithm? So we had this question from the audience, if government should really design infrastructures or if we should just rely on Google and on Yahoo and new Netflix, YouTube, et cetera, sites. And I think we can learn from them, and we should learn from them, but ultimately they have different audiences. I think we really should have the knowledge, expertise, ambition, and the collective money which it takes to set up a site where researchers can freely share research data, can freely share, ideally also, as much free publications as possible, and can freely share algorithms. Because what you would really like to have is not only the papers, which in many cases don't really have the exact description of the algorithm. You cannot replicate the experiment without actually seeing the lab book of somebody and really getting access to his code, to his data. But we should have cyber infrastructures which allow you to access the data which was used in this paper, to access the algorithm which was used to analyze this data set, and to then rerun this study and or feed in your own data, run through the same pipeline, or use the same data but run your own pipeline of algorithms, so that science becomes much more comparable, repeatable. And I think that's a hallmark feature of science. And technologically, that's very, very feasible. It's really just a matter of people wanting to do it and then, of course, resources. I mean, it does take a little bit of money to get a Hubble telescope, and it does take a little bit of money to get a particle accelerator, and it will take a little bit of money to get such an infrastructure, but I think it's very feasible. Thank you.